It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's the politics of wine. Our guest is Bruce Cass, co-editor of the Oxford Companion to the Wines of North America. He claims it's easier for a 13-year-old to buy a gun on the internet than it is for an adult to purchase a bottle of wine. And it all comes down to politics. Polar explorers Anne Bancroft and Liv Arneson will be calling in from their tent near the South Pole to talk food. They're halfway through their attempt to ski across the continent of Antarctica. Jane and Michael Stern are eating Hawaiian plate lunches in San Diego, and cheese expert Steve Jenkins talks butter with culture. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, I'd like to talk about fennel, both the vegetable and the seed. I think they're overlooked by a lot of people because they don't know how to use them. So here's a few ideas. First, let's figure out how to identify fennel. Now, the vegetable is sometimes labeled anise, probably because it has a subtle sweet taste of anise. What's interesting here is that a lot of people who don't like the flavor of anise like fennel. Well, there's something about it. I don't know what it is, but it makes it very appealing. Now, if you've never seen the vegetable fennel, it has stalks that look a lot like bright green celery and leaves that are lacy and delicate, like dill. The base of the stalks, though, plump up into these white bulbs that are about the size of a fist. Now, that's what you eat, and you can eat it raw, roasted, steamed, braised, almost any way that you'd like to cook it. Now, fennel seed comes from another member of the fennel family. It's called Florence fennel. It tastes sweet with hints of orange, black pepper, and, of course, anise. Now, usually you crush it or grind it to release its flavor. I love to cook crushed fennel seed with poached fruits. I put it in some pound cakes, and it's delicious with any seafood, with pork, and fennel seed, like fennel the vegetable, gets on with most green herbs. It loves garlic, tomato. It really is delicious with intensely flavored olives, hot peppers, and lemon and orange were made for fennel. Now, when Mediterranean recipes call for wild fennel, which folks who live in California might find growing on the roadside, but for the rest of us, we'll be up a creek. Anyway, when you want wild fennel, you can simulate its snappy character by mixing crushed fennel seed, orange zest, and black pepper, which, by the way, is a great rub for grilled or roasted pork or lamb. So you've already got one recipe. Okay, now let's talk about how to enjoy sweet fennel, which is what the vegetable is called. I always trim away the stalks because they're usually too fibrous to eat, but I freeze them for later use because I put them in fish stocks or I flavor stews with them. In the south of France, people take dried stalks of wild fennel and they throw them onto the fire when they grill fish, so it scents the flesh of the fish toward the end of cooking. Since fennel flourishes in the Mediterranean, most fennel dishes have Mediterranean flavors. Let's begin by talking about raw fennel. This is great to nibble on its own or with cheese or just put it in a green salad. Now, here's one of the easiest salads. It's done with fennel and orange. It's colorful and it's a classic. Just cut the fennel bulb into thin strips and arrange it on a big platter with rounds of peeled and sliced fresh orange. Add red onion rings, scatter some black olives on it, sprinkle it with a little olive oil, salt, and black pepper. Now, what I like about this salad is not only the taste, it's also that nothing can kill this salad. It doesn't wilt, and it gets better with sitting. Now, you can braise fresh fennel beautifully. Serve it on its own for supper or with grilled foods. Fennel gets along with garlic and tomatoes beautifully. So here's how you'd cook braised fennel. Film the bottom of a big shallow pan with olive oil. Brown together some coarse chopped onion and thick sliced fennel. Season it with crushed fennel seed, hot pepper, lots of garlic, and some white wine. Add tomatoes and cook until the fennel's tender. Then you can serve it hot or at room temperature. Now, for the most delicate and elegant fennel, steam it, dab butter on it, put Parmigiano on it, and run it into the oven. So the next time you see fresh fennel or fennel seed in the market, try it and tune in for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, featuring Henkel's top-of-the-line, fully forged professional cutlery. Henkel's is the knife choice of many professional chefs. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI Public Radio International. Well, today's show runs quite a gamut. We go from the politics of wine in the United States, among other things, to what two polar explorers are having for dinner in their tent near the South Pole. Let's start with wine. Now, if you look at the liquor laws in the United States, you find a load of contradictions. What's sin in one state is just swell in another. Our guest is going to explain some of the things shaping the attitudes behind these laws. He is Bruce Cass, co-editor of the Oxford Companion to the Wines of North America. Now, fat, at least good-tasting fat, is making a comeback. There's a whole new flock of cultured butters hitting the market. So we've asked cheese expert Steve Jenkins, who's a great fan of good butter, to explain exactly what cultured butter is all about and to name some names. His picks are the tastiest ones. I've got one proviso here. Bring money, because these babies are not cheap. There are at least two people in the world who could use a lot of butter right now. Have you heard about the polar explorers, Anne Bancroft and Liv Arneson? They're making history as we speak. They're skiing across Antarctica. Now, that's 2,400 miles. That's like skiing more or less from New York to San Francisco. Well, they're about halfway, and we're going to be talking with them about how their food's holding out. Then, as we do every week, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. It's in the second half of the show, and the number is 800-537-5252. But first, the two explorers we hear from every week are stepping into the studio. Jane and Michael Stern write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. So, Michael, Jane, where have you been?
We've been to San Diego. However, in San Diego, we've been eating Hawaiian food. And by Hawaiian food, I'm not talking about Polynesian poo-poo platters. I'm talking about real Hawaiian food.
Like what?
Like, for example, Kalua pig, which is a kind of soft, steamed, barbecued pulled pork mixed with pickly cabbage.
Ooh.
I'm talking about... Actually, what I'm talking about mostly is the love of Spam.
Are you saying that this typifies the food in Hawaii, Spam?
One of the things Jane and I learned when we wrote the Encyclopedia of Bad Taste several years ago is that per capita, Hawaiians eat twice as much Spam as the citizens of any other state in the Union.
Huh.
And in fact, Spam is a fundamental part of the Hawaiian diet.
Lynn, first of all, I have to apologize for my extremely weird-sounding voice. I wish we were in San Diego right now, but we're sitting here in 17 inches of Connecticut snow, and I've got the flu to prove it. But Dakines, or Dakines, I'm still not sure how to pronounce it. Dakine is a Hawaiian pidgin English phrase, which just means stuff. And this restaurant just has wonderful stuff. And as Michael said, Spam is one of the specialties. This is authentic Hawaiian food, not Trader Vic style faux Hawaiian food.
Uh-huh. So what? Give me a sense of what's on the plate.
Well, in fact, the name of the restaurant is Dakine's Plate Lunch, and that's what it is. You actually walk up to an order counter, place your order, and then they call your number when it's ready. So this is a real kind of blue-collar meal. And what you get on a plate, for example, is chicken katsu with a kind of soy sesame marinade on it, maybe ribs on the side of that. You might get Spam and eggs if you're in there for an early brunch. You might have saimin soup, which is a kind of brothy soup with scallions and little kind of nubbins of Spam in it.
You know, the funniest thing about this place is it has all the visual charm of a McDonald's. It's just like, it looks like a fast food franchise, but the food is so unusual. And I think their Kahlua pig, Michael, was one of the best things we've eaten.
Well, it was really unusual. I've never had anything like it. I haven't eaten in Hawaii, so it sure tasted authentic to me in the sense that it was nothing like the barbecued pork I've had anywhere in the continental United States. It was barbecued pork, but it was so kind of steamy and soft and mixed with that cabbage that gave it a real pickly zest. Extremely unusual. My one favorite dish, I have to tell you, Lynn, was Spam and rice. And what it was like a gigantic hunk of vinegared rice, kind of sweetened vinegared rice, with a big slab of Spam on top of it, wrapped in seaweed, like a huge piece of sushi.
That's exactly when you were describing
Spooshy.
The rice. I thought, this sounds like sushi rice. You know, the plate lunch in Hawaii, you're reminding me of this, was a great worker's classic. And it was always two servings of some kind of starch and then some kind of meat.
I would say that the Hawaiians are not really big on nouvelle cuisine, if Dakine's is any example. In fact, the cake, which was served, was the biggest portions of cake I have ever seen anywhere. One slice of mango cake was about the size of a box of Cheerios.
The woman who runs the restaurant, Belen Ishii, who is herself Hawaiian, explained that we had to have a piece of cake, even though we were really stuffed after eating our two-plate lunches. She said, "It is so good, it will break your mouth." Which I thought was, I never heard that expression. And indeed, it was good. It was ultra sweet. It was nothing like the kind of fancy boutique cake you'd get in an upscale restaurant. It actually reminded us sort of the best kind of cafeteria dessert. I mean, a big, simple, ultra sweet cake with gobs of icing on it, but mango flavored.
Well, forget about breaking your mouth. It breaks my heart that we're sitting here freezing in Connecticut and I have the flu when I want to be sitting on the patio in San Diego eating mango cake.
All right, Jane, I think we have to get you back to bed and get you some mango cake, maybe.
And I can dream of Dakine's Plate Lunch.
Hear, hear. Thank you, guys.
Bye, Lynn. Bye.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Square Meals, America's Favorite Comfort Food Cookbook. Now, they're kind enough to stop by every week, and by the way, if you're hitting the road yourself, be sure to visit our website at splendidtable.org for a complete listing of the Stern's restaurant picks. Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins lives for cheese. When he isn't selling cheese in New York City, he's hunting for his passion. That's artisan-made raw milk cheeses. He's the author of Steve Jenkins' Cheese Primer, and Steve stops by every so often. Hey, Steve, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
Well, Steve, what do you want to talk about today?
Well, I notice how interested my customers here in New York City are about butter all of a sudden.
You know, I don't think it's only in New York City. We're seeing butter tastings in the magazines, and I've seen butter, the fancy food stores are carrying these butters from Europe and, you know, butters from all over the place. So what's the deal?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's that people are getting jaded about olive oil. I mean, I'm an olive oil freak from forever, and I will be forever. But I have, as a cheesemonger, one of the many things I stole from French cheesemongers is they always specialized in great butter. So I did, too, because I'm a follower, not a leader. So I've always had terrific butter. The thing is, most American butter that you buy in the supermarket is very neutral. It's a wonderful product, but it's a very neutral tasting item.
Mm-hmm.
So I branched out, and I've got butters from all over the place, not just France. We'll talk about that a little bit more, but also from Finland and from Sweden and from Denmark and indeed from Spain. And they're all a little bit different from each other. The color's all different. And never forget what the Italians say, Lynn.
What's that?
The best French cheese is Normandy butter.
Yes, now that you mention it, yes, the Italians do say that. But, Steve, is there a real marked difference from one of these to the next?
Yeah, there is. It's a huge difference. And all you have to do is just slather it on a piece of toast or indeed saute something in a pan with some butter that comes from France, specifically either Normandy or Charente, which is the Deux-Sèvres department in western France, and then use some American supermarket butter like Hotel Bar or Breakstone or Land O'Lakes.
And
you will immediately perceive a difference in terms of aroma and aftertaste and mouthfeel.
But what is going on with these butters? Is it just that the cream is different, or are they made differently?
Well, the main thing that is so stark that sets American butters apart from French butters is that the French butters are cultured. That means that indeed they are started the way cheese is. There is a starter, a bacteria, that is added to the cream before they churn it, in order to consolidate the acids and to make the caseins link up and all of that scientific nonsense that nobody ever makes any sense of. But that also has a great, great effect on the finished flavor of cheese and indeed in butter. And they refer to that kind of butter as cultured butter. And it will have a much more pronounced buttery flavor than plain old Land O'Lakes. It just does.
All right, but now there are some American cultured butter. We have Keller and Plougras, who are made by it's the same butter, but with different packaging, from what I understand. And we've got Organic Valley. How do these American cultured butters measure up to butters from other parts of the world?
They measure up beautifully. The problem is they're not so easy to find. You have to go to a specialty store or to an assiduous supermarket in order to find Plougras and Keller and the Organic Valley.
Mm-hmm.
They're not so easy to find. You can find them in health food stores, but you can't be sure of it. I want our listeners to jump out there and get their hands on some French butter that comes either from Normandy or from Charente, and specifically the greatest butter in France, aside from the Fermier butter that you find in all the shops in France, which is completely illegal here. Fermier meaning it's made from raw cream. It comes in 30-pound plugs that they use a wire to swack off tranches, slabs, that they then wrap in wax paper. You won't find that in American cheese stores, but you will find the very best commercial butters, and the brands are Echire, E-C-H-I-R-E, which is from Charente, and Lescure, which is also from Charente, Lescure, L-E-S-C-U-R-E. And the best butter out of Normandy that's commercial is Isigny, I-S-I-G-N-Y, who, by the way, make probably the best camembert that
mm-hmm.
exists.
Yeah.
And these butters will really make the lights go on for you. They're just phenomenal butters.
What are they going to set us back?
Not so heck of a lot more. Well, you'll pay like $1.99 for a half a pound of commercial United States butter.
Uh-huh.
You're not going to pay much more than $2.49, $2.99. So, you know, it's maybe a dollar more. You know, in 10 years you'll have forgotten all about it. It's spectacular butter.
Steve, thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. Steve can be found behind the cheese counter at the Fairway Markets in New York City. You can find Steve's butter suggestions on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, how politics shape what we drink and polar explorers Anne Bancroft and Liv Arneson talk to us from their tent near the South Pole. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. If you listen to this show every week, what I'm about to say may come as a surprise. Most of we Americans do not drink wine. A lot of people find wine intimidating, snobbish, expensive, or offensive because of personal beliefs. Now, this brings us to the politics of wine. What has shaped our attitudes toward wine and, therefore, our laws? The book, The Oxford Companion to the Wines of North America, is a tome of the first water. It's the work of a group of experts. But what caught me up were the discussions of how politics, like liquor taxes, prohibition laws, and of all things shipping regulations, paint a strange picture of American attitudes toward wine. We've asked Bruce Cass, who is the co-editor of the Oxford Companion to the Wines of North America, to join us. Bruce, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Lynn.
So, Bruce, at this point, we have what seems to be this crazy jumble of different alcohol laws all over the country. Why isn't there just one set of federal laws that govern wine?
Well, I think every winery in North America is asking that same question. The short answer goes back to Prohibition. At the end of Prohibition, when the 21st Amendment was passed, repealing Prohibition, the goal was to disenfranchise the mob, which had become very vertically integrated through the distribution and selling of all of the alcohol during the 13 years of Prohibition. And so all the states were granted the rights to individually regulate alcohol sales in their state. And the first thing that most of them did was to require that there were a separate set of licensees, that any alcohol coming into the state had to go through a level of wholesalers and then a level of retailers. And so that has created all this just mishmash, this totally incomprehensible system of laws around North America.
The reason why they had to go through these different levels would be that they would have a tighter regulation on the legality, on not allowing the mob or illegal influences on wine?
Well, it's not so much a tighter thing as it is a matter of being able to keep track of licensees and collect taxes. Now, of course, back in 1933, that system probably made a lot of sense. But today, it doesn't make any sense of it at all. It's very easy to keep track of shipments and taxes and the payment and collection of all these things electronically today. So it's a system that is sort of outgrown its usefulness. Although, I will say this, that for the shipment of wine wines that are produced in large quantities and sold for relatively low prices, let's say under $10 a bottle, the three-tier distribution system that we have in all the states works just fine. The place that it doesn't work well is when you have tiny quantities of some extraordinarily fine product sold at a high price. Those wines need to have information transferred as well as the bottles. And so being able to transfer the information over something electronic like the internet and then ship through channels that go directly to the consumer makes an awful lot of sense. That only applies, though, to probably 10% at most of the wines produced in North America.
Well, one of the most confusing things is that I can't send a gift of a bottle of wine to certain friends who live in certain states. And it's just, I mean, is that this whole business about individual states having different laws?
A little bit. I mean, in the book, we refer to this as the direct shipping controversy, and this is a big political question today. All the little wineries around North America that have visitors come to the wineries would like to be able to call those people up later, 6 months later, and say, gee, you bought a bottle of wine from us. Would you like another one? It seems fairly straightforward, but it is not the way the system works today. And it does leave us with this strange situation where it's easier for a 13-year-old to buy a gun over the internet than it is for anybody, responsible adults, to buy very fine artistic bottles of wine over the internet.
Well, that puts it into a perspective probably we hadn't considered before. But Bruce, let's talk about who drinks wine and who doesn't drink wine. Where are the dividing lines in this?
Well, this is just a generalization. I mean, of course, there are all sorts of differences. I teach classes out here in San Francisco, and I have a very wide range of course, ages and genders and ethnic backgrounds there. So I don't want to make this sound like it's an absolute, but if you were to take a snapshot of the typical American wine drinker, it would be a person, usually white, college-educated, living in an urban area, probably between the ages of 35 and 55. Now, there's a lot of discussion about why there are not more younger wine drinkers. My own personal experience is that it has a little bit to do with disposable income. And as people get older and have families and are drinking wine at home with dinners, their consumption generally goes up. So I don't think it's so much an age thing, but certainly it is true that the great prize in the American wine industry today is to figure out how to sell wine to the Asian and Hispanic populations that have not traditionally drunk wine.
So we have a very different demographic of wine drinking than, let's say, people in Europe do.
Exactly. In Europe, everybody drinks a modest amount, whereas in the United States, 10-15% of the population probably drinks 85-90% of the wine and tends to do so in a different pattern. It's not a sort of steady consumption. It tends to have spikes in it. But these things are changing. We are able to see how in the last 20 years, so many districts around North America have resurrected wine industries that they had back at the turn of the century that were snuffed out by Prohibition. And I think that having a local industry does make for more interest in the subject and treating it as more of an everyday beverage rather than as something for special occasions.
And maybe eventually a real treatment of moderation.
Well, certainly that would be the experience looking at what happened in Europe, that the moderation ethic certainly is applied to most of the southern European countries, and there's very little alcoholism in those countries, whereas you take places in North America, let's take the Bible Belt as an example, where you have all sorts of restrictive laws about the hours of sale, and you have dry counties and so on, and there you find that the incidence of alcoholism is much greater because alcohol is not something in everyday life. It's only used for thrill-seeking, extra-legal situations.
It's human nature. Tell us we can't, and we try to.
Well, anybody who has teenage children probably understands that very well. Having been a teenager once, I think I can speak to that subject as well.
Bruce, thank you.
You bet.
Bruce Cass is co-editor of the Oxford Companion to the Wines of North America and is a founder of the Society of Wine Educators. Explorers Anne Bancroft and Liv Arneson are making history right now. They are the first two women to ski across the continent of Antarctica. Now, that's 2,400 miles. To put this in perspective, this is like skiing from New York City to just shy of San Francisco. And they're pulling sleds weighing 250 pounds, loaded with equipment. Now, needless to say, food is crucial here. Between the 30 below cold, the 100-mile-an-hour winds, and 12 to 16 hours of skiing, they each have to eat about 5,000 calories a day. Well, we have Anne Bancroft and Liv Arneson on the line. Welcome to the Splendid Table, you two.
Well, welcome. It's delightful to be here.
Now, where are you right now?
Well, that's kind of a hard question to answer. We're between an area called Queen Maud Land of Antarctica, where we began, and we're working our way to the South Pole. We've got just under 300 miles to go before we reach our, what we call sort of our midway point.
Now, are you on schedule at this point?
Actually, we're behind schedule. So it's fun that we're talking with you because we planned food for 57 days, and today is our 57th day. So we're a bit we're going thin here for the next 6 or 8 days, which we anticipate we could be out here.
So what does that mean? I mean, like, for instance, what are you guys going to have for dinner tonight? I'm worried about you now.
Well, it's we have actually a lot of calories, and we're doing two different kinds of activities. The first activity is pulling, which you mentioned, which uses a lot of calories. And then the second activity that we really look forward to and need desperately right now is sailing, dragging our sleds, and it uses a little bit less calories. And so we've actually packed more lunches and breakfast than we actually need. So we're going to live off of that for the next little bit. Dinner tonight is splitting a little cup of soup. And tonight it was tomato, and boy, did that taste good after a day of chocolate. And then when we get off the line with you, we're going to fire up the stove and have a cup of cocoa that's been beefed up. We'll each have a granola bar for dinner.
I want to come down and cook for you too. This is terrible. But I understand that in the intense cold, it's really hard to get enough heat to cook. How does it take to pull a meal together generally?
It's actually very easy. We have dried food. We have a stove that it's fired by white gas, so we just put hot water in the dry food and wait for 5 minutes, and then we have pasta bolognese, cod with potatoes and things like that. But right now we are quite out of that, so there will be soup for the next week.
I see. Liv, tell me something. I understand that the climate on Antarctica is drier than the Sahara. What do you two do to keep from dehydrating?
Yeah, we drink actually a lot. We melt snow and mix sports drink on 2 to 3 thermoses per day and have an extra thermos with hot water in our sled. And right now when we are pulling, we actually drink 3 thermoses per day.
I see. Is it tough to melt the snow?
No, it's easy. We have a comfortable tent, and we have a section that we call the kitchen, and we have every other day we have a duty in the kitchen. So it goes quite fast, actually. That's the easy part.
So tell me, what's the most challenging thing about the food for you guys?
I think right now when we have so much sweet stuff left, and we really are looking forward to get some other taste than chocolate and bars and things like that. So we have some spices. So Anne was has kitchen duty today, so she put the garlic powder in or tomato soup, so that tasted delicious.
Is there some specific food each one of you is really craving right now?
I think both of us are looking forward to get some cheese when we reach the South Pole.
Uh-huh.
Cheese and salad or apple or something like that. That would taste delicious.
Are you going to, do you have any preparation to celebrate once you reach the pole? Like a bottle of bubbly maybe stashed away on the sled?
Well, I have I'm Norwegian, and I'll always bring a little, tiny little bottle with akevitt. So I think we'll have a little sibit share, a film canister of akevitt if we have something to celebrate, like Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. So I've saved a little bit to when we reach the South Pole as well.
Thanks so much, you two. And we're following you so closely, and we really hope that all goes well. But I am concerned about your lack of dinners at this point. I wish we could airdrop some great food for you that will keep you nourished.
Well, actually, I wish we could airdrop you and have you cook us up a whopping meal.
I have to tell you, both of you, I would love it. I mean, it sounds like such an incredible adventure. Hey, thank you both very much, and good luck. I don't
want
to keep you from the work I know you have to do. Take care.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Polar explorers Liv Arneson and Anne Bancroft are attempting to be the first women to ski across Antarctica. Now, to learn how to track their progress, go to our website, splendidtable.org. And one other thing, Liv wanted us to share with you a recipe from her mother that they have on special days out there in that tent in the middle of Antarctica. Anyway, it's her mother's Kentucky cake. Now, why a Norwegian would do Kentucky cake is another issue. Anyway, you can get the recipe two ways. Either send a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or go to our website. That's splendidtable.org. Are opening the lines for your calls. Now you can get to us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to it. We've got Kay on the line. Kay, what would you like to talk about?
Hi there. I would really like to know how to make that prepared ginger that I get in the Japanese restaurants, the kind that's sliced.
Oh,
it's,
yeah,
a little bit of vinegary and sweet. Oh, it's so wonderful. How do I do that?
Oh, boy. Okay, got to put on the thinking cap. I love that stuff. I put that stuff in salads. I just grill salmon and put it on top of it. Of course, you can put anything on top of a piece
exactly.
of ground salmon. You know, be good. But basically what you want to do is, first of all, if you possibly can, start out with a young ginger, because older ginger may have great flavor, but older ginger tends to be very fibrous.
How do I know what young ginger is?
Young ginger usually shows up in the market probably in the next several months, and it is almost transparent looking. It's very almost pinkish gold on the outside, and it actually sometimes has little green nubs at the top of the pieces of ginger. But if you can't get it, you can use the other ginger. It's just that if you want to be really exacting,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you run across this new ginger, what's called new or young ginger, use that. But the basic thing you're supposed to do with this, if I recall correctly, is you take the ginger, let's say a half a pound of it, you peel it, and then I once made it, and I made it by using a vegetable peeler to peel long, thin slices of it. You know how it looks when you get it
right,
with the sushi.
I thought perhaps that might be the way.
Yeah, a vegetable peeler. And then what I did with it was I took boiling salted water, and I just poured it over the ginger and let it sit for a few minutes. I think I got this out of a book on sushi or something.
Okay.
And then drained that off, just left it for about 2 or 3 minutes. And then you put it into a mixture of some, about a half a cup of water, maybe a teaspoon of salt, 3 tablespoons of sugar, 2 to 3 tablespoons of sugar, some sugar, but not a lot, and a whole cup of rice vinegar.
Rice vinegar.
That's the key, because the rice vinegar has that great, soft, nice... And you stick it in the fridge for 3 or 4 days.
And you just let it simmer in there.
You let it just sit there, and it is good stuff.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome, and enjoy it.
I will.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Hey, it's time for our trivia question of the week. Talking with polar explorers Anne Bancroft and Liev Arnesen were the inspiration for this one. What food was a mainstay for early explorers trying to reach the poles? And, by the way, it was also a mainstay for mountain men in the Old West and even for the first pilgrims who landed at Plymouth Rock. So what food was it? We'll be back in a moment with the answer and more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We have open lines for your calls this hour, so give us a ring. The number's 800-537-5252. We are on it. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. Our conversation with Anne Bancroft and Liev Arnesen down in Antarctica inspired this one. The question was, what kind of food was the mainstay for early explorers heading to the poles? Here's another clue. It was also used by the mountain men in the Old West and even by the first pilgrims who landed at Plymouth Rock. So what was this mystery food? It was something called pemmican. Now, essentially, this was dried meat that you pounded into a powder, mixed with a lot of fat and some kind of dried fruit, like wild berries. Often there was a sweetener added too, perhaps maple syrup. The pemmican was formed into little balls that you could carry in a pouch that you attached to your belt. This was trekkers' food. Before modern dried foods and nutrient supplements, pemmican was protein, maybe vitamin C, and certainly fat, all literally rolled into one. It was easy to carry, and a little went a long way. But it's the range of times and places where you find mentions of pemmican that really interests me. Pemmican traces this loop around the earth. Start at the North Pole, and you see that in 1820, a British explorer named John Richardson stocked up on pemmican for his attempt to reach the pole. Skip to the early 1900s, loop down to Antarctica, and find Ernest Shackleton eating pemmican as he struggled to reach the South Pole. But all this began with the American Indians. I've got this picture in my mind of them greeting the pilgrims at Plymouth Rock with a plate full of pemmican. Native Americans were making it long before any foreigners landed here. I just think it's interesting that polar explorers saw its value hundreds of years later. But, you know, with food, everything seems to link to everything else one way or another. Okay, it's time to get back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who's been waiting patiently. We've got Susan on the line. Susan, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I'm going to be teaching a dessert-making class to elementary-age kids, and the facility has only convection ovens. I've never used a convection oven, so I don't really know, you know, how it cooks, but I'm mainly interested in how I would translate a recipe, because most of them are for conventional ovens,
right,
with regard to, like, both temperature and time.
You're a cooking teacher.
No, I'm not a cooking teacher. I'm a social worker, but I'm just, cooking is something I enjoy doing, and I work with kids, so I have an opportunity to do this, and it sounded fun.
Hey, this sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, on one hand, when I hear you say convection oven, I have to make a confession. The wise remark to make is lots of luck. But
No.
Convection ovens are great for baking.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, the whole idea behind them is they're blowing hot air all over the oven so that there are fewer chances of hot spots or cold spots. So, but because they're doing that, things tend to dry out and things tend to cook a little faster. So with your baking, what kind of recipes are you going to be doing with the kids?
All different, you know, cookies and cupcakes. And,
right.
I suppose if I got fancy, you know, maybe a couple of, I don't know, brulee or, you know, who knows?
Well, I think that would be real kind of sexy and fun.
Yeah.
But the thing is, generally speaking, you knock the temperature down 25 degrees.
25.
Yeah, so if the recipe's 350, you do 325. And you do a good preheat. You know, obviously, you let the oven come up for 20 minutes or so.
Okay.
And then I'd say check what you're cooking sooner rather than later.
Mm.
And, you know, I can tell you knock down 25 degrees, but it's hard to say if your cookies cook in 10 minutes, you know, it'll be exactly 8 minutes. But I would say if the cookies normally cook in 10 minutes, I would check them after about 7 minutes.
Okay.
But other than that, you have no problem. My problem with a convection oven is when people want to use it for every kind of cooking that they do, because it does tend to dry things like meat and that kind of stuff out. It can, depending on the design of it. So, but I think you're going to enjoy it because it's a great baking tool. It's a baker's oven more than anything else.
Okay. And like the finished product, does it, I know like a microwave, for example, doesn't really brown stuff. Does a convection oven do everything that a regular?
Absolutely. And it may do it even more thoroughly. Because you know how when you put a sheet of cookies in a normal oven, you notice some get darker and some get lighter?
Uh-huh.
That's your hot spot and your cold spots in your oven. The whole idea behind convection and the fact that it's got a fan in it that's blowing this hot air everywhere is that ideally that does not happen. So you're going to get nice, even browning and even cooking.
All right. Well,
you're going to enjoy it. It's a great way to work with kids, I would imagine, and probably breaks down maybe some barriers.
I think so. I think they love it. In fact, it's at an after-school program, and there are tons of things offered, but the majority seem to sign up for this. So something about it.
I think if nothing else, they know they get something good to eat.
Exactly.
This is good. Hey, good luck.
All right.
And if you want to, give us a call and let us know how it works out.
Okay.
Take care.
Thanks. I love your show, Lynn.
Hey, thank you, dear.
All right.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
For calling. Goodbye.
Bye.
This business about convection ovens, they've become very chic lately and very popular. And I just think you should be aware of what they do very well, which is bake, all this beautiful, even heating. But the things where I think, the area where I think they perhaps are not at their best is things like roasting and doing dishes where you want a lot of moisture in the dish. And that's why if you're going to invest in an oven, and let's face it, usually people have ovens longer than many marriages last these days, you may want to think about one of these ovens that you can convert to convection for when you bake, but then it functions as a normal oven the rest of the time, so that you get the benefit of the moisture cooking for all the savory foods. And then when you're baking something, you've got that hot air blowing around and it gets all that nice even heat everywhere. Let's see, who's up next? We've got Selena on the line. Selena, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, you are.
All right. Now, tell me, what is on your mind? What pressing issue do you have that you'd like to discuss?
Oh, well, I've had a vanilla bean for a long time. and I'm not sure exactly how to use it.
I picture you putting it in a little pouch and carrying it around with you and keeping it close to you. How long have you had it?
Possibly a year, I think.
And where have you stored it?
It's in its original bag.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, it may have dried a little, but it's still going to have great flavor. Well, let me explain the basics of a vanilla bean. First of all, it has, of course, flavor that's even richer and more intense than, let's say, vanilla extract.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of ways of using it. First of all, you can literally just stick the whole vanilla bean in, let's say, a canister of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And it will scent the entire canister of sugar. In fact, even when I've used a vanilla bean, you know, infused it, put it into liquids and flavored with it, mm-hmm. I dry it out, I wash it, I dry it out, and I put it back in my sugar canister because it just keeps giving. The vanilla bean never stops being part of your life. This is the key to a vanilla bean.
A perpetual vanilla bean.
Now, one of the things that you can do with it is you can do what you would call infusions. It's kind of like making tea. You take a warmed liquid and you split the bean, okay, because inside the bean are all these little moist seeds, and they are lush. They're this intense, rich, velvety vanilla flavor. And you just can split the bean down the center and tuck it into milk, let's say, that you might be using to make a custard, or maybe milk that you're just going to drink. Now, if you want to come up with a recipe guide, let's say normally you make a custard or a cheesecake or something like that, that calls for 2 teaspoons of vanilla, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you want to substitute the vanilla bean, you would take half your vanilla bean, split it in half down the center so you get to all that niceness in the center of the bean, and scrape that out. And the seeds from about half a vanilla bean equals about 2 teaspoons of vanilla. Yeah, but you can keep reusing it. So it goes into any liquid that's going to end up being a custard. I've actually put vanilla seeds into the butter that I use to finish sautéed scallops and lobster. And that's sensational. Just a little swirl of butter in the pan after I've sautéed the fish with a little bit. I scrape the vanilla bean into that barely melted butter. And you put that over the fish. Okay?
Yeah, people don't often use vanilla for savory dishes.
That's right, and it's delicious in savory dishes.
Okay.
All right. Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Talking about vanilla beans, you know, this is the time of year I always clean out the spice cabinets. Here's some of the hard facts about storing your herbs and spices. Leaf herbs, okay, like basil, oregano, that kind of thing, generally are in their prime for only about 3 months. So when you buy them, just buy enough for 3 months. Now, anything that has been ground into a powder has about the same amount of shelf life. If it's whole, like a whole spice, peppercorn, cinnamon stick, whole coriander, whole cumin seed, those will often keep for 5 to 6 months. Peppercorns will keep a year or more. The last thing to know about your spices is always keep your herbs and spices away from heat and away from light. Okay? So get to cleaning out those spice cupboards. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we are ready for any of your questions. John's calling. So, John, what's up? What's on your mind?
Well, the easy way to put it is we have 3 kids and absolutely no time. You know, we have a 5-year-old.
I'm not available for babysitting. I'm sorry.
Oh, come on. You know what? You'd be able to cook up such great food for these kids. So we were hoping that you'd help us here.
And they'll probably break your burst into tears and say, we want to go to McDonald's.
I hope not.
Oh,
no, seriously. And it's really, you know, we have a 7-month-old, a 2-year-old, and a 5-year-old. And literally, there's no time to cook.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking for the not Kraft macaroni and cheese solutions. The healthy, you know, because really my kids eat really healthy. They love their vegetables. I mean, they love vegetables.
This is great.
For the most part, they eat vegetables before they eat their cereal in the morning. So I'm a strange father in that sense that my wife and I do these things. But at any rate, We've got them eating well. Now the question is, what can we cook for them that is geared towards kids and is fast?
Really fast.
Really fast. You got 15 minutes, that 15-minute window.
John, I think you are a Mark Bittman person. Now let me explain. Mark comes on the show periodically. He does the minimalist column in the New York Times. And Mark was put on this earth to streamline recipes. His book, How to Cook Everything, has short, smart, good recipes. That's one thing.
And they're healthy.
They're healthy. And he has another book. It's called The Minimalist Cooks at Home. Okay, so those are two books. Yes, they're both healthy.
And that's the most important thing.
Yeah, and he's got good ideas for vegetables. And, you know, this is talking like 4 or 5 ingredients and not a lot of time. And streamlining stuff and still keeping good taste. Whole foods, too. You know, not substitute this and take this from a box or a can.
That's the important thing.
He's never met a bouillon cube. You know, think about this. So I'd say The Minimalist Cooks at Home and How to Cook Everything. Two things to think about. The other thing I'm thinking about, too, it's a book written by Marion Cunningham about cooking with children. And I can't remember the exact name of it, but it's these wonderful, simple, delicious recipes. And Marion is a born cooking teacher. I mean, she's a brilliant teacher. And she works with kids and very down to earth. And if you look for Marion Cunningham, you know, go to Amazon or whatever on the web, there's got to be her book about cooking with children, which I think you'll get a kick out of. And it's the kind of food you're going to want to eat, too.
That's important.
Yeah. By the way, I just think it's great you guys are doing this for your kids.
Well, you know, it starts with them.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah, exactly. And it's just this whole business about what kids really like and don't like.
Well, you know, I think we're lucky because our kids are pretty... They eat healthy. They like all sorts of different foods. But the question is you know, it's too easy to fall back on a box of Stouffer's, and you don't want to go there.
Yeah, I understand.
And you just want to give, and you plus you want to be able to eat it yourself and enjoy it. And a hot dog, you just don't want to do that to a kid. and I'm sorry for all the people out there that are probably listening to the show thinking I'm a really idiot for saying that, but, you know.
No, but I understand. You have 5 nanoseconds every day that you have enough energy to pull a meal together, so you want to know how to do it. Hey, congratulations on it, and I think you're going to really like these sources.
Now, what about that babysitting? Now, what's your address for that now?
Ah!
Thank you so much for your time.
Hey, you're welcome, John. Thanks for calling.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Look, I'm going to admit, I don't have kids, but I don't see what the big deal is about kids not eating people food. You know, you make good food for your kids, they're going to rise to the occasion. Thanks for joining us today. Hey, remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And before we go for the week, let me leave you with an observation from Augustus Saint-Gaudens. He said, "What garlic is to salad, insanity is to art." Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, offering the latest cooking tools and gadgets, from colanders to ladles to timers and garlic crushers. Target has the selection of cooking tools to fully outfit your kitchen, online at Target.com. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That's splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.